Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Over the past month, you've heard encore presentations of some of our favorite episodes so far this year. And today, as we prepare to move forward into season 22, we're looking back on some of the highlights of our guest interviews from 2023. We'll start with our conversation with journalist Jamie Bartlett. Jamie is a specialist in online culture and technology, and recently wrote and hosted the hit BBC podcast series, The Missing Crypto Queen. Here, he and Steve talk a bit about the approach law enforcement organizations have taken in responding to cybercrime.
There are some countries where it's, yes, they will naturally take a much more front foot approach than perhaps others that will be sitting back a bit more and saying, well, actually, no, the responsibility is yours.
I have found, though, to give them some credit, again, I was extremely pessimistic about the ability of policing on the dark net. I feel like they're getting much better at, I suppose you could think of it as old-fashioned policing, but in a virtual space.
Right.
You know, actually getting into these forums, going undercover, becoming sellers and buyers themselves, working out how they operate these marketplaces for stolen data, for example, starting to undermine confidence in the system by, let's say, for example, you know, the markets on the darknet operate like Amazon with user reviews.
Yep.
So you go on there and start messing with the user review system, giving everyone one star out of five rather than five.
Yep.
Slowly working your way up the organization, collecting data and then prosecuting people. And you've seen that's got a lot better. And that's encouraging because when I speak to the sort of police or the authorities, I always say, you probably have some amazingly talented, very young bobbies that have joined, that are 23 years old, they've just started, you've put them on the beat. You might have an incredibly gifted gamer here who actually understands how this works.
Yeah.
Why don't you find what skills they've got?
Yeah.
They'll understand how the cyber culture works in gaming communities and where crime might take place and stick them on that instead. So I think there's a wealth of talent as the 22, 23, 24, 25-year-olds are joining schools and joining the police. I don't think we're tapping into it enough yet. So that's some that's a practical thing I think police could do better.
What about the collaboration piece, law enforcement cross jurisdiction? You know, one of the challenges they've always faced is, to your point, that cyber criminals don't just sit in one location. They're spread around the world. And they do know those areas that are better for them to be established than others. Well, what are the sorts of things that you've seen law enforcement do better in terms of collaborating across those jurisdictions?
Yeah. It's obviously very hard if you're talking about corporate espionage in China, you know, sort of totally uncontrollable cybercrime from Russia. There's very little we're actually able to do about that, frankly. They have been better, though, with... Again, I come back to the dark web because it's the area I sort of know well. Within the dark web, actually quite a lot of the sort of people running these marketplaces or key sellers are often based in the Netherlands, Ireland, the UK, the US, places where we do have cooperation between authorities. And Europol in particular has taken a bit of a lead at trying to coordinate investigations into particular dark web sites and particular dark web people. For a period, they were actually running some of these marketplaces. They take them over and then run them to gather as much intelligence as they could and then coordinate mass arrests, sort of pretty impressive multi-jurisdictional operations. That is something that didn't really happen much 10 years ago. And in a way, the sort of the multi-jurisdictional nature of the dark web has forced police authorities around the world where they can to actually work together. And it is much better than it was, but it's, again, I come back to the fact that it's still quite limited.
Next, we hear a bit from Steve's discussion with Aaron Painter, the founder and CEO of NameTag. Aaron is the best-selling author of the book Loyal, based on his experience living and working in six countries across four continents. Here, Aaron shares some of the insights from his book.
And what were some of the sort of tips that you outlined at that time that business leaders could perhaps follow or try out to try to improve some of the challenges they were facing?
For me, one of the most interesting periods was when I first moved to Hong Kong. And you think, Hong Kong, at least they sort of speak English there. And it turned out working in my industry and technology, the ecosystem was actually quite local. It turned out the sort of English speakers were often people maybe working in finance, and the people working in tech had been quite local. Cantonese was maybe their native language. And when I came at first, the team that I was sort of set to manage, our Microsoft team in Hong Kong, felt like things were going well. I said, you know what, don't come disrupt things. We're happy here. You don't come bring a lot of outside energy, so to speak. Things are very consistent. We know how things are done. And yet our business results at the time didn't say that. Our business results said things could be a lot better. And so when I first started, I sat literally in a room of people and I said, hey, we're going to start to have one-on-ones. I'd love to hear from you how you think the business is going and maybe things that you think could be better. I went on sort of what I now think of as a listening tour, as one sort of piece of advice I often give. And I went on this listening tour and asked a lot of the folks then, what could be better? What ideas do you have? And they were stunned at first. They said, well, we're here for you to tell us what to do. I said, well, I'd love to hear from you first. And just sitting back and listening and allowing others to share their thoughts and ideas turned out to be great insights that allowed me to then put together a plan based on other people's ideas, because they knew the market best, of things that could be different. It turned out then that some people were in the right roles, others were not. They might have been very talented, but they might not have been placed in a role that could take advantage of their talents. And I was able to get a sense of that from some of the conversations. I was also then able to get a sense for where there could be different personalities or different skills that we might bring to the team. So it let me go shape what open roles and a kind of a hiring plan should look like. But most importantly, the people that I was working with and managing started to feel a sense that I respected their opinion. The next thing I did, I would try. I said, you know what? I'm not going to sit in an office and close myself up in a kind of my own room. They didn't like that. Culturally, they still said, hey, give it some space. We think, you know, you should sit in your own office, but you can leave your door open. But I was trying to send that message as many ways as I can, that others' opinions mattered and that I didn't come with all the answers, but I came with enough questions and enough respect of the local team to try and learn from them and combine it with practices maybe that I knew were working well for us in other markets. And that formed the basis of a successful sort of business turnaround plan at that point. And people started bringing energy to it. The energy started to grow because people felt like I respected them such that they could maybe have an idea that wouldn't work and I still might be open to it. And that began to create a sense of trust across the team. And ultimately, that became a core part of our cultural tenet and really something that took that business from one that wasn't successful to one that was wildly successful.
Next, we hear a clip from Steve's conversation with supply chain expert Omera Khan.
And in your experience, because you talk to a lot of people in both the public and private sector, what is your perspective today on how supply chains have matured from that collaborative trust perspective versus where they were, let's say, 2 years ago, pre-pandemic?
I think that a lot more companies are beginning to recognize the importance of working together. And I think partly that agenda has been very much driven by the whole building a more sustainable supply chain. So mm-hmm. How do we become more sociable, equitable, and a responsible supply chain? So I think that's partly been driving that behavior of a much more collaborative organization. I think also the fact that so many companies were basically, they were surprised by the risks that they faced during COVID, not having access to key components when they needed, a shortage of semiconductor chips, for example. I mean, we moved from a just-in-time system to a just-in-case system, but the supply chain wasn't ready for that. So I think there was a lot of shock waves that rippled through supply chains during COVID. That really was a wake-up call for much of the industry to recognize that, you know, it's by together and it's through a much more partnership approach that we can, one, detect when something's going to happen and we can hedge those risks together. We can share the damages perhaps together. Mm-hmm. It's through those kind of mechanisms, I think, that's really driving the maturity of a much more collaborative way of working. I think also, you know, looking ahead a little bit, I really do think the collaborative partnership approach will see a lot more of that as we start working cooperatively more together. So it's understanding that, you know, our competitor may be actually our best partner at times mm-hmm. when we need to share or gain access to vital warehouse space, for example, right? We don't want to necessarily build new warehouses now that we might be shifting to a much more localized or regional space, but it's about gaining that knowledge or gaining bandwidth in the supply chain by accessing space in distribution centers or warehouses when we may most require it. So I think going forward, we are going to see a lot more of a collaborative approach, both across our supply chains, vertically and horizontally and so forth. And I really do think it's the whole sustainability, climate change agenda that is one of the driving forces for that. But then I think digital technologies are also an enabler of allowing these things to mm-hmm. also mature and happen. So I think, you know, I think it's a really fascinating time for us to be in supply chains right now. We have a lot more enablers through the technologies, through Industry 4.0, that are allowing us to access 3D printing technology in collaboration with machine learning, in collaboration with AI. But at the same time, we can't forget the people in our supply chain as well, because it's the people who are driving some of these metrics and these performances as well. So I think we are really shifting from an adversarial, transaction-based approach to supply chain management to a much more collaborative supply chain, I think, to a world where we're in an ecosystem of supply chains, which includes our customers and our customers' customers. So I think we really are going to see a new landscape in supply chains very soon. If not, we're already beginning to see that.
And now here's a clip from Steve's conversation about data integrity with Rafael Marti, Executive Vice President and General Manager of Cybersecurity Management at ConnectWise.
You've talked there about confidentiality. You talked a little bit about sort of availability and standards and frameworks and so on. The piece that worries me the most, actually, is neither of those these days. It's actually the integrity of data. And I say that because we're using so much more technology from an artificial intelligence perspective, machine learning. And of course, you know, you have to be absolutely sure that the data that you're putting into those systems is real, that it hasn't been tampered with. And you made the point earlier on about, you know, software isn't 100% secure. Data is not 100% secure either. And yet we're moving to this position where we're almost making assumptions, or some organizations might be criticized for making assumptions, that the data they're using is of a high integrity. How can we assure business leaders, people listening to this, for instance, that the integrity is a key issue? What are the steps that could be taken to protect the integrity of data?
It's a fantastic point. With the conversations about artificial intelligence and machine learning and all that, the data you're feeding these systems, especially the data you're feeding the systems to learn and then draw inferences from that, is so crucial. If there is bias in the data, if there has been malicious changes to the data, that will let your systems train the wrong things. It's an incredibly hard problem to solve. How do I know that my Excel spreadsheet hasn't been tampered with? It starts with, again, it's really data protection, right? You have to make sure that you start with access control, that only the people that should be able to access a document can access it, that only the people that should be able to edit the document can actually edit it. Not everybody that you're sharing a document with should be able to change it, right? But the hard part here is that these access controls can get really out of hand. And it's hard to make sure that the right document is only available to the people that need to have it, that only the people authorized can change the data. But I think we can do better. If I get a financial spreadsheet, for example, from finance, well, finance is the authority on the spreadsheet. I should not go in and change the data and then reshare the spreadsheet with others, and that's now the new truth, because the governor, the person or the entity that is authoritative here is finance. If I have a problem with the data, I should go back to them so that they can fix the root cause, right? So these kinds of workflows need to probably be more guarded and governed in the end. But it's really, really hard, as you're saying, right? And once I receive a document, how do I know it has not been tampered with? And one of the only ways to do that probably is if you have very, very detailed audit trails on who has accessed the data in what way. And if you see someone in that chain that should really not have touched that data, you probably want to push it back and make sure that you get the raw data again and someone can regenerate it. But it's an incredibly hard problem. And we haven't even touched on what it does to machine learning and artificial intelligence if you don't have the right data. It's not even necessarily just making sure that the data hasn't been tampered with, but even just a bias in the data is going to make a big difference.
Finally, here's an excerpt from Steve's conversation with Margaret Heffernan, a professor of practice at the University of Bath School of Management.
Now, one of the other questions I always get from boards is, and I'm paraphrasing here, but why is it that we can't measure security in the same way that we can measure everything else?
Yeah.
What makes security so special?
Yeah. Well, because in a way, you know, you're going to measure your success by how little you have to measure, right?
Right.
So it is one of these things of trying to measure the invisible, that it's successful to the degree that all sorts of terrible things don't happen. And I think, you know, one way to think about that is to take a broader overview and say, okay, so this is the rate at which cyber attacks are happening. This is the rate at which they succeed. Are we doing better or worse than that? So you have to look at that general sort of data. But, I mean, I was in a board meeting a couple of months ago where they brought in an external expert to talk about, you know, the cybersecurity landscape
right.
and so on. And I mean, the board's jaws dropped mm-hmm. when they saw actually how consistent cyber attacks are and why. And I think it was actually understanding there is this whole infrastructure of people who see there's a vast amount of money to be made here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the past, I mean, I may be being a little unkind, but I don't think I'm being, you know, deliberately mean. When I say, I think the board had mostly gotten their impression of cybersecurity from movies, where they thought they were slightly dysfunctional, long-haired, unwashed individual maniacs
right.
poking away at laptops. And that, I mean, I don't need to tell you, you know, that environment has changed so radically.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
In the same way that organized crime is part of our real-world life.
Mm-hmm.
It is now a part of our cyber life. And we have to take the same protections against it. But you're going to measure it by how much doesn't happen.
We hope you enjoyed listening back to some of our favorite interviews from this year. You can find the full episodes in our feed and in the show notes. And of course, you can also look there for links to other ISF resources. Season 22 begins next week with an episode featuring Dr. Andrea Matwishan, professor of law at Penn State University, whose work centers around the intersection of technology design, innovation policy, and law. In the meantime, if you would take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening, give us a 5-star rating and write a quick review, we'd be grateful. You can also listen to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in-depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod, music by Alexander Filipiak. Thanks for listening.